everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you today?
Fantastic.
I'm very excited that we're going to be having Jim Meehan on the show, friend of ours.
Always good to have the old friends on the show, for sure.
And he's got a new book out, but we'll talk about all that later. I read in the New York Times recently about the Eric Asimov column was all about Calvados and how it's an underappreciated spirit and how he really loves it. And, you know, he doesn't drink it that often. But, of course, fall is the time and winter is the time
to be drinking apple brandies.
Calvados is apple brandy from Normandy in France. And Normandy is where grapes don't grow very well, but apples grow beautifully. And so the ciders and the Calvados, which is the cognac-like spirit made from apples, is amazing, age-worthy, and beautiful.
Calvados is one of those things that Francis and I have talked about for years and years.
I mean,
as long as we've been bartending, we've been turning people on to Calvados. Because I have found that dollar for dollar, I enjoy Calvados better than cognac.
100%. 100%.
I think that there's so much more value in Calvados than there is in cognac. And not that I don't love cognac, but I just see all that value. Being able to find 35- and 50-year-old Calvados reasonably, and, you know, expensively, but reasonably.
Right.
Just 50-year-old cognacs are not reasonable.
If you, if we were richer, they would be. we got to work on that there. The funny thing is, I like all spirits. Of course, now we're in the realm of brandy. And you may not realize the distinction of what is a whiskey versus what is a brandy. So here's a little free education. If you already know this, please bear with us while we cover the basics. A whiskey, okay, here's what, if you distill a product from a grain base, you have a beer. So barley,
wheat, corn,
and actually
rye.
Sake, because it comes from rice, is technically a beer, not a wine. So that's kind of a cool thing, huh? So, and then if you make a distillate from a beer, that becomes a whiskey. And so that's what whiskeys are. If you distill a fruit, not just grapes, but any fruit, it becomes a wine. So you can have apple wine, you can have elderberry wine, and most of the wine we drink is grape wine. And then if you distill a wine, you get a brandy. So the base ingredient of a brandy is a fruit, and the base ingredient of a whiskey is a grain. That's the basic distinction. So we'll confine our comments here to brandies. And I love brandy, and I love it this time of year. And if you look at French brandies, I think the king of French brandies is, of course, cognac. Its rustic and rough-hewn brother in a flannel jacket who's out hunting is Armagnac.
Yeah, also an underappreciated region.
Have you been drinking Armagnac? Because you really need to be able to say it.
I did You're not have my Wheaties this morning. I'm sorry.
I think that was crazy. So Armagnac, we love Armagnac as well. And Calvados is, and you know, I said cognac style brandy only because it's done really well and it ages beautifully. It doesn't taste like a cognac, but
very distinctive. Calvados is distinctive.
Yeah, I find that it can achieve the same level of complexity and certainly the same level of enjoyment as a cognac, and they are extraordinarily age worthy. Mm-hmm. And cognac Calvados is actually a blend of few Calvados producers make it from only apples. Camus, our friends at Camus, make it in only apples. Most people make a blend of apples and pears, and if there's an inner appellation of Calvados called the Dom Frontés, where it's mostly pears. But whatever fruit it's from in the base, it can run the gamut from being bright and lively and crisp, like a pretty young apple off the tree in nose, and then give you kind of a cognac feel in the mouth from the wood and the aging, to heavy, and by heavy I mean with gravitas and substance and sweet spices and more along the lines of, say, a baked apple.
But one thing that I want to point out is where I think that cognacs don't really taste like grapes. I find that Calvados really does taste like apples.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they can just rise to such tremendous levels of complexity, and you can get older stocks of Calvados that are amazing. Look, they're not cheap, but for a similarly aged cognac, it would be much more. And most of the Calvados production is small production. Mm-hmm. And so you get a lot of individuality. And I can't speak highly enough about a producer that we carry, Camut, C-A-M-U-T. They have all of their Calvados, they're entirely from apples, and they tend to be more, you know, weighty and baked apple type. And they have cognacs, Calvados available up to 65 years old that you can pick up. And it's not everywhere, but it's somewhat available. And I find this, we are very interested in spirits. And one of the things that I think is wonderful about old artisanal spirits, especially when you're not talking about the big houses, and some of the big houses make some phenomenal spirits. I think there are more big houses that produce, you know, really large quantities of some really very good spirits than most of the wineries that produce really large quantities.
I think there's a big difference there. Distillation is different than making wine.
Well, and the thing about it is, when you get that bottle, it's more stable. Mm-hmm. Not if me and my cousins are around, but if they're not, but if we don't live in your house, it can last a long time.
Sorry, I laugh so hard at that because most of the bottles that have been emptied in my house have been by Francis and his cousins.
I just am trying to create memories for you and for us all.
And
know.
Get rid of your own?
It's another dead soldier. But the thing is, you can have a glass of whiskey and then put the top back on the bottle and mm-hmm. put it in the cabinet and then not have, you know, not come back to it till next fall. And it's just the same as it was when you left it.
Or very nearly, yeah.
Mark and I came up with this crazy idea. We're always thinking about crazy ideas. I'm surprised and delighted with the success of it, but we call it the Spirits Project. And we stole the idea from a guy with permission.
From a cognac producer, yeah.
Who does this for the industry, does it for professionals in Manhattan. But we do it for consumers. We do it for everyone. At 6:30 every Thursday, we open a single bottle of some extraordinary spirit, and we pour 1 ounce taste of it at cost. And we work with our distributors so that we get it on a month when it's posted off to a favorable price. And we take that bottle, and there are about 24.34 ounces in a bottle. And so there are 23 portions, because Mark and I always split one. And, you know, the thing about it is, in a way, spirits aren't that expensive because you don't have to drink the whole bottle in a sitting. The bottle doesn't go bad within a few days after you open it. But in a way, the barriers to entry can be very high.
Sure,
because
$500 to spend on one bottle of liquor is a lot of money.
Exactly. Now, that has 24 portions in it that are each, you know, somewhat expensive, but you got to upfront the whole money, mm-hmm. all the money. And the other thing about spirits like that, what if you buy a bottle of something crazy like that and you taste
you don't care for it.
You don't care for it? Well, now you got a $500 bottle of something with you know, 12 more glasses in it.
Well,
what are you going to do?
The issue here is, and how are you going? Are you going to do that every week? So
right.
what we've tried to accomplish with the Spirits Project is, well, now you can taste a Scotch this week and a tequila next week and maybe some interesting Calvados the week after that. And, you know, there's a cool old rye that we have or whatever it may be from week to week. It gives you the opportunity without that big commitment.
So we basically have poured everything from bottles that retail anywhere from $200 a bottle to maybe $1,000 a bottle is what we've done. And we sell them for between $4.50 an ounce and $19 an ounce in a snifter in a 1 ounce portion. And again, it's one bottle. We open it at 6:30. Sometimes it's gone before 7:30. Sometimes it lasts until 11 or 12. And one or two of the bottles have made it to the next day when it reverts to full price. Thank you very much. But what I love about it is, you know, it's not, you know, we don't really hawk our own restaurants on our radio show. But what I love about this is the level of interest that's out there and the conversations that people have about this. And the whole point of it was to start a conversation. I don't need to make any – I don't make any money on the things that we're selling. But the interest in spirits is really out there. And if you have a local bar or a local restaurant – that, you know, the Wine by the Glass program, if they have a good wine preservation system, they really need to manage that. And unfortunately, in most of the country, most of the restaurants don't manage their wines by the glass very well. And very often, even in New York, all around the country, especially outside of major metropolitan areas, I go, and even when people have wine preservation systems, and a lot of those don't work very well or aren't used properly, I get mediocre or over-the-top wine.
I've gone to some really good restaurant and gotten some fairly middling wines by the glass.
Because they've been mistreated. And we know the wines have been mistreated.
If you're a long-time listener of the show, you've heard me say it before. One of the things I do if I'm going to order wine by the glass is I rarely choose by variety or
what was open today.
What'd you open last? What's the last thing you opened?
And I'll be honest with you, I don't like those Cuvenet systems. I don't like the gas systems. And we may as well give a plug for an occasional sponsor who's also a friend who we have his wine preservation systems in our restaurant, and we are converted skeptics. It's called Vinfinity.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Vinfinity.com, and if you drop our name, he'll charge you a little more. No, I don't know. Maybe he'll take care of you. But a guy named Armando, it's a great preservation system, but it's not flawless.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get a week out of our wines, which is amazing. You know, most of our wines will last a week under Vinfinity, and we don't have them open for a week, so that's great. But, you know, there's a chance you're taking with a wine by the glass. A spirit by the glass? You can't screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, even if it's on the bar and it's a little too warm because the bar is warm, you put a little ice in there, or you can chill it down by yourself, let it cool. It's hard to screw up spirits. They're very durable. And so you can get the true experience. And one of the ways to utilize a great bar with a great spirit selection is to be able to do it a portion at a time. You know, I think that's amazing. I love the conversation we're having. And one of my favorites coming up, you can check it out on the website or email us, and we'll tell you when it's happening. I have some eau de vie or some schnapps from our friend Hans Reisebauer.
Francis has a dear friend from Austria by the name of Hans Reisebauer. And he brought back, I'm going to say it's 14 or 15 years ago, you brought back schnapps from Hans Reisebauer.
Mind-blowing.
And they're expensive. Okay,
oh,
let's
yeah.
not, let's,
oh, doggy.
Let's
they're
not,
expensive.
Let's not pull any punches. They're expensive. But Francis has been chatting about Austrian eau de vie since the dawn of time, pretty much.
And, you know, we do Calvados and cognac and Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey, but eau de vie is a clear, or schnapps in Austria, it's not like the root beer schnapps that you get in the store. It's clear, it's not sweet, it's a spirit right off the still, so it spends no time in wood, and that's why it's clear. And it's distilled from fruit, and that's why it's very expensive. So he has, you know, framboise, or Pear William is from pears.
It's not always from fruit.
Right. Sometimes well, that's true, but usually it is traditionally from fruit. Framboise, kirsch is from cherries, and you need hundreds of pounds of cherries to make the tiny amount of liquid. And what Hans has done, he's taken it, he's pretty widely recognized as one of the greatest producers in the world of this type of spirit, but he is using carrots.
Yeah.
His Karottenbrande is amazing. He's using ginger. And so we have one evening coming up on Thursday where we're going to do, you'll get an ounce of each, an ounce of Karottenbrande and the carrot and the ginger. It'll be like a fall kind of Thanksgiving-y kind of spirit thing where you get to taste both. And they smell so intensely of what they are. And the other thing he does that's really crazy is he has cherry and wild cherry eau de vie. And the wild cherry is, I mean, if you've ever seen wild cherries, they're tiny and they have a big pit and they're difficult to deal with and they taste totally different. And one of them is about $100 a half bottle and the other one's about $200 a half bottle. And we're going to pour them side by side. So the idea is, they're enjoyable, but also it's interesting and to strike up a conversation about great spirits. So, anyway, it's the time. We encourage you to drink in moderation and all things in moderation, including moderation itself. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And today, our guest, once again, is Jim Meehan. Jim is an owner of PDT Cocktail Bar in New York City, one of our favorite cocktail bars, and an old friend that we even predates PDT. He's one of the best bartenders in America, one of the most recognized bartenders in America, and he has just written maybe the most beautiful cocktail book I have seen in the last 10 years, the PDT Cocktail Book.
Hey, Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys, and thank you for that flattering introduction, Franny.
And Jim is also one of the few people in the world who can call me Franny and get away with it, because I can't hit him, he's too far away. No, it's all right. So the PDT Cocktail Book, I have to tell you, Jim, you showed me some sketches, and you showed Mark and I some sketches as the book was a work in progress. You told me the concept of it, and I was excited by that, and I saw a couple of preliminary drawings. It's really a beautiful, substantial book that everyone must have. If you care about cocktails, you have to have this book.
Jim, I can tell you, I spent a fair amount of time on the sketches and the stuff that you sent, the preliminary stuff you sent us, but I have spent very little time with this book because Francis has been hoarding since the day it came.
He said, "I thought that was on my desk." It was on your desk.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, when we wrote this this book plan, and we went and we spoke to different publishers, and the publisher that ended up picking up Sterling, they are sort of renowned for they're renowned as book packagers, and you know, Carlo DeVito, who was the editor who bought this book and really sort of spearheaded this whole process. You know, he showed me all these different books in our early meetings. Things like the Esquire Handbook for Style that was wrapped in wool suiting, and just kind of all these cool books that really were things that like jump off the table. Sterling is owned by Barnes & Noble, so when they create a book at Sterling, they're selling it to Barnes & Noble, and I think nowadays so many books are bought on Amazon or they're bought online, and they're not necessarily bought in a bookstore, certainly not like a local independently owned bookstore. So I think that one of the things that Chris and I were committed to from the beginning is creating a book that was as beautiful and sort of as interesting and captivating as an object as it was as a sort of reference book. I mean, I think you guys know very well that, you know, between Dale's books and Dave Wondrich's books and Ted Hayes' books and Robert Hess's books, there's so much great information now out there about cocktails, and there's so much, you know, Greg Bohm's reprints. There's so, you know, the cocktail book market has gone from there not being enough information about cocktails back when all of us were, you know, when you guys bought your cold draft machine and created your beautiful cocktail bar, and I was back at Pegu and Gramercy Tavern. There wasn't enough information then, but now there's not too much, but it's a lot to sort through.
So more than you need.
What Chris and I, part of the plan all along was make it beautiful, make it something that, you know, your mom would give as a gift, maybe to someone who's never going to make a drink in it, but who can appreciate it, you know, as an object.
Well, Jim, you know how you pick up a gold bar and it's a little heavier than you expect it to be?
Yeah.
That was kind of what happened to me with this book. I was like, hey, what's that? It's not made of paper.
It is. I think it's 1.8 pounds or something like that.
Okay,
it's,
and this is not... when we talk about a heavy book, I think of a coffee table book, and this is a book, if you're cool, you should leave on your coffee table. But it is not a big format coffee table book. This is like a 6x10 book, but it weighs, 1.8 pounds?
Yeah, basically when we were talking to Sterling about it, for me, I collect a bunch of old cocktail books, and if you look at the size of, you know, the 1862 Jerry Thomas or the Cafe Royale cocktail book or the Savoy cocktail book, some of the sort of the really benchmark classic books, they're not that big sort of coffee table format. They're more of a manual, like a sort of technical manual size that back in the day, I mean, people, you know, I wouldn't imagine that in, you know, 1930 there was a library behind the bar, but certainly these smaller, more technical style manuals were behind some of these bars. Many of the books of the time, like Jock Straub's Drinks or the ABCs of Mixing Cocktails by McElone, were the vest pocket size, where the bartender would put the sort of book in their vest and they'd sort of have that to refer to. But one of the things that I realized as we were figuring out this package was, you know, nowadays my bartenders have their recipes on their BlackBerry or they have their recipes on their iPhone, and really the future of bartender, at least bartender recipe books, are apps. They're not books. So it was a strange realization to spend so much time thinking about the size of the book and the feel of it and then realize that bartenders may not even put this behind their bar. But that being said, I'm excited that Sterling let us kind of do this more classic style package.
Well, leave it to a bunch of cocktail geeks to spend 10 minutes talking about the paperweight of the cocktail of the cocktail book. Jim, I do think Francis and I see a lot of books, and you know, a lot of these books are coming either self-published or they're coming out, and you can tell, you know, and we're book geeks. Most cocktail geeks are book geeks at some point in their life as well. And so you can tell. You pick up one of those books, and you know it's not. It doesn't have the same substance.
You know, and
I have to say that this, you know, just like you were talking a little bit about self-publishing, and most of our most writers, I'm not a writer that I don't write to make money. You know, writing is sort of like a sideline. I'm a bar operator. You know, I do a there are a lot of other things I can do that are sort of the lion's share of my income. So I think writing is a luxury for me, and I think that with that respect, you know, like doing the Food and Wine book or all the other work that is edited, I think there's such great value to. I mean, any great bit of writing always is the result of a great editor, someone overseeing the project. And I think that, Diane Abrams and James Rodewald, who were refugees from Gourmet, which folded right before this, you know, a huge surprise to all of us in the food and wine and world. Carlo brought Diane Abrams on to sort of be the lead editor for the Epicure department, which was, you know, to have a former editor of Gourmet as your book editor, and then James Rodewald, who used to do the drinks column for Gourmet, is now living in New Mexico and opening up a bar, funny enough. He was the one who copy-edited the book. So to have them as sort of resources to help make this book what it is now, I mean, it just wouldn't have been in that without their help.
I want to get into the meat of the book in just a moment, but just to spend, you know, it's funny, we've spent several minutes now talking about the book as an object art, you know, it's the illustrations are beautiful and we need to talk about them separately, but it's clear to me, and obviously I have a little insight because we've spoken about this as you were writing the book, that you wanted to make a book that was a cocktail book of its time, and we go back a long way. When we were both, like you said, scrounging for bits of information, and we found different cocktail books written in different cocktail periods, and we would share information almost like they were, you know, did you see this book or did you see that book? And I think you've really written a book for its time. And I'll tell you, one of the things I found very interesting is we have a really talented young bartender that works for us, a guy named Chris Stanley, who I think you may have met. And
yeah.
Chris was in the office, and Chris is also quite the book geek and the cocktail geek. And he said, "So you leave those books in the office, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He's like, "You sure you want to do that?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, see that one up there? That's worth about $700, and that one's worth about $500." And I had no idea.
Crazy.
Well, a lot of these old books that you and I found and scrounged around it. I mean, I got some of them at antique stores and book sales for $3, you know, but the originals are actually there is a value to the object of the book, and I think that your book here is just a value to the object of a book. It's not just the recipes, it's the context, and like you said before, now we have so much information. I think what people really need to process that information is a point of view, and I think that's what you get out of a book.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've been blessed to do, I'm on my sixth Food and Wine book, and I got to do 4 Mr. Boston's with Anthony Giglio, our good friend. And, you know, I think that in doing those books and also working with, you know, the editorial staff at Food and Wine and then working with the editorial staff at Wiley a little bit, you get a feel for what Mr. Boston is obviously a force of nature of book brand for cocktails. So that book was never really mine, but it was amazing to sort of